Hey, what's up, MC Nation? Before we get started on this Jesse James Part 4 episode, which has taken me a long fucking time, very long time, I'm glad this is about over with here. I do have to get some stuff out of the way. First off, live show, July 28th, Indianapolis, Indiana, at Wave 1 Radio on 120 East Market Street. From 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., it will be me, Shane Waters from Out of the Shadows, and Jerry and Tracy from Hillbilly Horror Stories. We will all be doing our own episodes live. This place is fucking amazing. This is legit. Like, we got 150 seats in there. Tickets are $10. You can stop by any three of our Facebook pages and find the link. We usually try to post the link about once a week just to keep it up, you know, so it's not like buried in other posts and stuff like that. This place is really fucking nice. It is fully sponsored by Wave 1 Radio, so it'll be really, really, really cool. I do think we have probably, I know within the first couple minutes we sold like 6 or 7 tickets. So I know they are going, you know, at a pretty decent rate, so, you know, stay up on that if you can. It's going to be a badass time. Don't worry, I will not. There's no alcohol that is going to be served here, so you don't have to worry about Justin getting drunk and, you know, answering a Q&A question for like 10 minutes straight, going into like every minute detail you could ever fucking imagine. And because of that, now I get made fun of a lot by Jerry and Shane, but hey, you know, it is what it is. I will be attending the Dark History and Horror Convention in Savoy, Illinois on November 9th and 10th. I will be doing a live episode there as well. This convention is not really a podcast convention. It is literally just for like horror, like indie filmmakers, you know, in the horror genre, and some dark history. Just all kinds of awesome shit. There's plenty of stuff on Facebook and on the internet about it, but I will be performing a live episode there. I do not know all the details of when I will be doing it yet. I still got to work out some details with the guy who runs that. So just so you know, I will be there as well. Let's see what else is next. Merchandise. We do not make our own merchandise at ACC Productions anymore. I have gone to Threadless. So if you go to mcpodcast.threadless.merch, wait, no, it's .com. Fucking, I'm a fucking idiot today. So mcpodcast.threadless.com. You can go in there. You can buy all kinds of fucking shit. There is hoodies, t-shirts, shower curtains, coffee mugs, bags, handbags, cell phone cases. I have 2 different designs going on in there right now. I will be adding more. I just started that thing like yesterday. So, you know, I'm adding it as it comes. If there is something specific that you do want, that you want to buy, just let me know. Hit me up. I can make it up and throw it in the shop and then you can buy it. So all the people who had promo codes for merch previously that were Patreon supporters at the $20 a month level, I have been trying to get a hold of most of you. I think there's 1 or 2 that I haven't gotten a hold of yet. And what I'm going to do is once I get like a promo code type thing for Threadless, I will be giving you that instead. And it'll pretty much work the same way. And hopefully we can be squared away with that. I do know that there are a couple more that I have to reach out to. This literally just happened yesterday, so a little bit behind on that. Next thing is Patreon supporters. I actually adjusted my levels, okay? And I wasn't doing this to be like greedy or to be an asshole, but I got requested to do a super fucking big Patreon episode that usually if I did it on my regular feed, it would be a 2-parter for sure. It is an unsolved homicide of several people. So it's basically the amount of research that I'm going to have to put into this. I did have to do certain tiers. So how this is going to go is anybody that is $1 to $4 a month, Patreon supporter, you get all episodes that I usually release that are under an hour in length. A lot of the Patreon episodes I have been doing are ones that are never before been covered and that don't have very much information on them. So they've only been about, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes or so. This one is not going to be that way. This is going to be like 2 hours. I'm going to have to put a lot of work into it. It's going to probably be at least 2 hours. I'm going to have to put a lot of work into it. So, you know, we have the $1 to $4 range, which get all the other episodes. And then I have like the $5 to $10 range, which basically is all the longer Patreon episodes plus the shorter ones. And then I have the next level, which is you get all the episodes plus once a month. Me and you can sit down and do a Skype call for an hour. We can talk about whatever you want. We can talk about unsolved cases. We can sit there and literally drink beer and have a staring fucking contest. For all I care, that's cool too. Whatever you want to do, just get a hold of me. And then that is the $10 a month tier. But that is the $10 a month tier. You get all those extra episodes plus the hour long Skype call once a month. And then there is the $30 tier, or actually we'll go to the $20 tier, which is you get a promo code for the new merch shop, plus all of the other stuff that I just forementioned. And then I have the $30 a month thing, which is where you get the Skype call, all the free extra episodes, the promo code, and you get to select an episode that I will personally do live for you over Skype, and then we can talk about it afterward. If you want that to be recorded and released on my feed, we can do that too. That's totally fine. That is your decision. Or if you just want it to be your episode, that is fine too. It is all up to you. So yeah, we do have the first tier, which is $1 to $4 a month. Second tier, which is $5 to $9 a month. The next tier is 10 to 19 bucks a month, and then 20 to 29 bucks a month, and then 30 bucks a month, blah, blah, blah. All right. And then if somebody who is a dollar a month patron, because as you guys know, the Patreon supporters are the ones who choose the Patreon episodes. That has nothing to do. If you are not a Patreon supporter, you do not choose the episodes. I do not choose them either. This is what you guys are paying for. This is what you want to hear. If somebody who is a lower tier supporter, like if you donate $1 a month and you want a big, huge episode, then I will personally record that episode and I will make sure that I personally send it to you as well, even if you're not in the upper tier. So you still get that episode. So, you know, there's that. I think that's pretty much it. I think I covered everything. I would like to thank Christine for helping me out on some of this research. And I would also, who else helped me? I thought somebody else helped me out on some research, but I don't think anybody did on this one. I do gotta say most of my research in this episode is a book by a guy named David Keene called Knights of the Golden Circle, Secret Empire, Southern Secession, and Civil War. There is so much information on the Knights of the Golden Circle in this episode. I also got to give credit to, it's a book called Jesse James was one of his names, by Del Schrader and Jesse James III. Obviously, Astonishing Legends. I hope all of you took my advice and listened to their 3-part episode on the KGC. There is some information in those episodes that I will be using because it directly relates to what I was trying to research. So I do have to give a huge shout out to Astonishing Legends. They are fucking amazing. Other than that, sorry for rambling on for almost 10 fucking minutes now. There will be some reviews after this episode as well. Okay, I'm done. On with the show.
The Knights of the Golden Circle was a secret political and military order of pro-slavery men and slaveholders. And they had as a goal the creation of an empire.
Jesse James, long considered a self-interested bandit, may have been something else. A secret operative with a hidden political agenda.
Jesse James tried to live underground for his entire adult life, so our knowledge of what he actually did and thought and said is very limited.
A group of Confederate sympathizers operating at the time of the Civil War, the Knights of the Golden Circle, or KGC.
The KGC was real. I could spend 100 years probably studying this stuff before I knew what it was.
The order itself was under the scrutiny of the federal government from its conception. So, you know, they had rules concerning not writing anything down, and even membership rosters were not kept. You know, it was a very mysterious order. It was similar to the Masonic order. It had secret signs and grips and passwords and rituals. So these things tended to make the order itself very mysterious. Plus, its objectives were not really clearly known by people. There is a lot more to be learned about Jesse James. Yes, we know about the bank robberies, but what was his political leanings during that time period? What was Jesse doing, besides just robbing banks? That's where we need to go.
Alright, so I'll start off this episode with saying the KGC is not really a conspiracy. It is proven to have existed. This is a part of our history. So, in order to understand the KGC and whether or not Jesse James was possibly a part of this and could have possibly been funding this or maybe even buried treasure somewhere all over the US and possibly parts of southern Canada, we're going to have to examine the KGC itself, how it started, who started it, why, where, all of this shit. So I guess we're going to go back in time a little bit, and we're going to touch on the guy who officially is known as starting the KGC, and his name is not Pike. His name is George Bickley. George Bickley was born in Southwest Virginia. I'm not exactly sure where, and I'm not exactly sure what year. His father did die when he was young, and his mom sent him away to live with relatives when all that happened, because she was what they say, I'm trying not to be like politically incorrect about this. She was kind of gallivanting around, if that makes sense. So that was kind of like her thing. So she sent him to away to live with relatives, and at the age of 12, he left, and he just started roaming around. He started roaming around the South quite a bit. He actually started a trading business in Alabama. He eventually fathered a child in North Carolina, and what he ended up doing, he started studying with a doctor in the field of phrenology, which phrenology is kind of a medical field. It's where they feel the bumps on your head and all that shit. If you're not familiar with it, you should really look it up. It's pretty interesting. Some people think like it's total absolute bullshit. Other people fucking stake their reputations on it. But he pretty much got a quote-unquote degree in phrenology, and what you had to do back then in order to be a medical doctor was you had to study with a different doctor for, you know, about, you know, a year or two or something like that, and then you were allowed to practice by yourself. But we all know how those, like, old-timey doctors are. It's all about, like, oh, you got the demons in your blood. You better go do some cocaine about it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, total absolute bullshit. Technology was not there. They, you know, they literally did prescribe cocaine for some shit. I shit you not. Okay. Like, it was honestly like a medical treatment up until like the early 20th century. So like, you know, when I say that, I'm not totally bullshitting. So after he gets his quote unquote degree in phrenology, he ends up going to a medical institute in Cincinnati. And he convinced the head people there that he had studied in Philadelphia and in London with like top medical people and that he was like super, super good at what he did. Okay. And as you know, there, it is stated in a few different places that, George Bickley was a really fucking good liar. He was a fucking con man. But a lot of this is fairly documented, so we do know that a lot of it is true. Now, he gets to Cincinnati, and after he convinces these people that he had studied all this places abroad and in Philadelphia and all this other shit, he literally became a medical professor, and he taught for several years at this medical institute in Cincinnati. He ended up marrying a very wealthy widow because he was all about like advancing himself, making himself rich, important, and all this other stuff. He was, like I said, he was pretty much a con man. You know, after he marries this wealthy widow, wealthy guys back then, they didn't have shit to do, all right? So they would make up these little secret societies, and they would all go hang out with the fellas and, you know, do whatever, you know, the fuck you do in, like, secret society type networks. I don't know. Now, he starts bouncing around in these secret societies, and he kind of wants to start his own, all right, for, you know, a couple different reasons. The main one being he wants to be the leader of something. He wants to be powerful. He wants, you know, that incoming money. Bickley actually published his first book, and it was called Atalaska or The Strange and Mysterious Family of the Cave of Genreva. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word. And it's pretty much an anti-slavery novel, believe it or not. It's based on that whole Manifest Destiny and the Young American movement. And then he also published Principles of Scientific Botany. He also published something what is referred to as the Western American Review, which is a New York-based conservative publication. He did write a couple of books that were pretty good, but obviously the first one in 1853, which was based on that premise of the Manifest Destiny, is the one that he is known for the most. So a Manifest Destiny is, it's kind of like a doctrine. I think the phrase was coined in 1845, and it's basically built around somebody's philosophy on the expansion of the U.S. and, you know, going out and branching out. It's kind of hard to explain, I guess you could say, but it's basically, like I said, it's a doctrine of expansion. You know, it's the philosophy of expanding the U.S. Onto other greater territories. This was all going great, okay? Until his wife finds out that he's trying to steal all her money. The bank ends up getting a hold of her and saying, hey, you know, your husband's trying to transfer all of your money into just his name. You know, so she ends up kicking his ass out of the house, and he goes back to Cincinnati because he had moved away prior to that after he started joining his secret societies with his rich wife and shit. So he goes back to Cincinnati. He starts teaching at this medical institute again because, like I said, he's a very good con man. He's a very good liar. This is, you know, kind of when he starts getting the idea of the KGC. This is where he really starts developing the rituals and the basic structure of the KGC because he has a shitload of time on his hand. The basic structure of the KGC came from Sir Walter Scott. What he did was he started getting involved in these resorts, okay? And these resorts had like a night motif. It's really kind of fucking funny because it's like seriously like some Excalibur shit. It's like knights in shining armor. There's lords. There's ladies. It's like this resort where everybody is like a medieval fucking knight. Okay. They had jousting matches and shit like that. This was like a really huge thing. All right. So people like invested time, people invested money, and this is for people of wealth. So, you know, there was a lot of people into this shit. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like the thought of jousting somebody, I'm pretty fucking sure I would do it. It's, I don't know. It just sounds super awesome. So after he starts, you know, getting into these resorts, what he does is to help fund the quote unquote Knights of the Golden Circle, which is kind of how he got that name. He starts heading to the South and he goes back down to the South to hit up plantation owners to start raising money for his quote unquote Knights. While he's down there, He meets some people involved with an organization or a secret society known as the Order of the Lone Star. All right. Now, the Order of the Lone Star was formed in 1851. Interestingly enough, it was a society that its sole purpose was invading other small countries and making them U.S. territories. Now, I know this totally sounds ridiculous, but I don't think people realize how close we came to invading Cuba in 1851. I shit you not, we were loading the ships, like getting ready to head there and invade this country and take it over and claim it as a U.S. territory. Now, the Order of the Lone Star had 50 chapters and about 15,000 members at this particular point in time in the early 1850s. How the Order of the Lone Star was expanding into other countries was basically a thing called filibustering. Now, a lot of people today know filibustering as somebody who's, you know, into politics, who doesn't want to build a pass or wants their voice to be heard, and they literally just talk for fucking 10 or 13 hours straight and make everybody sit there and make them fucking miserable. But that's not what it was back then. Filibustering back then was when you went to other smaller countries and you brought like your own little private army. And a lot of these smaller countries back then were already in war. They were already in like a, you know, an inter-country war. You know, you would have a military commander and he would recruit like his own little personal army. He would go to port cities like San Francisco, New Orleans, New York, and you would recruit a bunch of young guys, pay them, and all this good stuff, and you would form your own little army. And you would go to South and Central America to these tiny little countries, and what you would do was you would approach one of the sides of this war that was already going on, and you would strike some kind of deal for power, within this country, and then you would help that side fight the war with you. You know, you would basically just help take over the country. As ridiculous as this shit sounds, there was a couple successful attempts at this. We were successful a couple times in doing this, and probably the most notable one was in Nicaragua in 1855. A former, Tennessee doctor named William Walker formed his own little personal army, and he went to Nicaragua in 1855, and he helped one of those sides take over, and they won. One of the first things they did was they made Walker president, and they started reinstating slavery. This was actually going pretty goddamn well until Walker ended up pissing off a Commodore Vanderbilt. Like, if you've never heard that name before, they got into a little bit of dispute about some shipping routes and stuff like that. And Vanderbilt basically paid all the surrounding smaller countries to kick Walker's ass out of Nicaragua. And that's pretty much how it went down. He wasn't in control very long. But, I mean, it is pretty interesting to know that this filibustering was successful a few different times. Like I said, this is the most notable one, so it's really the only one that I'll mention. So a lot of this came to a head right before they invaded Cuba. A guy named John Quitman. Now, John Quitman is important because he was a general in the Mexican War. He was also a former governor of Tennessee. This guy almost single-handedly raised $1 million and 50,000 men for this invasion of Cuba. Now, this would have happened, like I said, in 1855. This is when the whole plan was going to go down. Now, the administration at the time in the U.S. was Pierce. He was kind of not really for it, not really against it. He was, hear no evil, see no evil type of thing, you know. But at the last minute, he calls in all of his top guys and he decides to change his mind, and he threatens to actually arrest a lot of these guys. If they would have gone through with it, he would have arrested them under the Neutrality Act. So that ended up not going through. Like I said, we were literally manning the ships. Like, we were getting ready to invade and take over Cuba with thousands upon thousands and thousands of men. So, I mean, that's a pretty cool little fact in history. And don't get me wrong, like, you guys might think this is all on a side note, but this all ties into the KGC as a whole. I'm trying to tell you the base of it. So, when everything goes to shit, basically, in 1855, you know, the real reason Pierce kind of changed his mind was because of Congress passing the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Now, the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed the previous year in 1854, and it allowed people in the territories of Kansas and Nebraska to decide basically for themselves whether or not to allow slavery within their own borders. Now, this single act alone served to repeal the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery north of 36 degrees, 36 minute latitude, which would be Missouri. So this basically, he was like, listen, dudes, no, we're about ready to have a bunch of shit going down. We just passed this act. People are pissed. People are happy. There's about to be some shit going down. People think the start of the Civil War was, you know, the late 1850s, early 1860s. In all reality, the starting leg of the Civil War got its first steps, you know, as early as the 1820s, with the Missouri Compromise. Because, I mean, and these two acts right here, especially the Kansas-Nebraska Act, was one of the main reasons that Abraham Lincoln even started getting into politics. I mean, if that says anything, like, there was a pot of just boiling water that was getting ready to boil over, and pretty much most of America knew what was getting ready to happen, because it was, I mean, it was extremely, extremely tense right now. So when the Civil War does actually break out, it took him a little while to join. He didn't join until early of 1863, and he joined the Confederate Army as a surgeon under General Bragg. And then really didn't last too long. He left for Tennessee in by the summer of 1863 in June. And then in July, he was arrested as a Confederate spy in New Albany, Indiana. And that was in July of 1863. He was never actually tried, though, and he still stayed in jail for about 2.5 years until October of 1865. And supposedly after that, he kind of left. He went to the East Coast, Virginia, Maryland area, and he ended up dying in August of 1867 in either Virginia or Baltimore, Maryland. They're not really too sure. So after him, the Knights of the Golden Circle kind of, they kind of took their own shape, and pretty much is the inspiration for the modern day Ku Klux Klan. You know, like I had mentioned earlier, you know, by the time the Civil War hit, the Knights of the Golden Circle was kind of dying out, but there were still members that were very, very adamant on this being a thing. And the remaining members of the Knights of the Golden Circle were not going to let this society die. They still had this plan, and they had been hoarding all this gold and all this treasure, and still had all this funding coming from other countries as well. I mean, they were extremely prominent around Louisville, Lexington, Cincinnati area, obviously, was where George Bickley spent a lot of time, a lot of Southern Ohio. There was a lot going on in Texas, obviously, Missouri, Tennessee, just pretty much all over, and actually Northern Mexico. If any part of your family came from Northern Mexico anywhere after 1870, you should really get your DNA checked, because there's a good chance you got a gringo somewhere in your fucking bloodline, because there were so many Confederate soldiers after the Civil War that immigrated to Northern Mexico because of, You know, some of it was because of the KGC, but that was like a very, very small percentage. But a lot of it was because of the way of life. They were trying to keep slavery going, and Northern Mexico was one of those parts. Because the Knights of the Golden Circle was, you know, a huge circle surrounding, you know, Northern Mexico, Central America, South America, the Caribbean, you know, and back up through the South. This was going to be their reign of power, you know, for slavery and their own government. And it wasn't just America that was involved in this, because there were a lot of other countries that would have benefited from this happening too. There were a lot of outside investors and just a lot of people that were going to make money off of this slavery. Unfortunately, you know, that's a lot of what it was about. You know, with all of that little bits of knowledge behind us, you know, George Bickley, basically, when he meets up with the Order of the Lone Star, and they have what they refer to as castles. Like I said, he had that whole, you know, medieval motif going on with these resorts. So he referred to certain like safe havens and like safe houses. And it was known places that the KGC were safe, because either a known member lived there or they were friendly to the KGC because they might have had a relative or been a supporter of some kind. Now, remember that, okay? Remember that for later on. These places were called castles, okay? What he does is he takes all his little separate people, his little separate groups of people and his like own little private army, and he joins up with the Order of the Lone Star, okay? Now, shit starts getting crazy here, because they literally have this whole structure, you know, with the KGC. Like, they had different degrees. Like, you know, the first degree was referred to as, you know, the Order of the Lone Star, which, like I had previously said, at its height of power had 50,000 members. Now, the first degree, which was the order, like I said, the Order of the Lone Star, they were the army. They were the boots on the ground. These were the guys that did the grunt work. They did the killing. They did the moving. They did the invading. They did all this stuff. They moved guns. They moved money. They were the army. The next up was the second degree. The second degree was the Order of the True Faith. These guys were the enablers. They were the money men. They were the, you know, the editors of the newspapers that kept certain things out or put certain things back in, and it would all be coded. Now, there are several, you know, instances where it's speculated, you know, a lot of messages were put into newspapers and various news reports and stuff like that, to where other KGC members were known, and this would include photographs as well. Now, when we start touching on Jesse James' involvement in the KGC, we are going to refer back to a few pictures that him and Frank were in that were known to be them giving symbols saying, hey, we're members of the KGC. One of those known symbols would be to take your right arm during a picture and tuck it to the inside of your jacket across your chest. That was one of the known symbols. There were several others as well. Like I said, the second degree were the money guys. These guys funded everything. They were funding the armies. They were funding the recruitment. They were funding the safe houses and the safe havens. They were paying the guys in the armies. They were paying, you know, what they called the sentinels. You know, the sentinels were the people who guarded the payments to the known KGC members that were lower tier. And then we have what is referred to as the third degree, which was the Order of the Columbian Star. Now, the Order of the Columbian Star were the top military and political members. These members' identities were kept secret. They were only referred to as numbers. And that's why we don't truly know who a lot of these top people are, but we can only speculate. The reason we know all this stuff is, ironically enough, Texas. Texas is the only reason that we have a lot of this information. Texas, for some odd reason, provided a lot of documented paperwork on the KGC and its history. Now, Bickley did gain most of his support in Texas. Out of the 50 chapters of the Knights of the Golden Circle, there were 32 of them in Texas. So that's where we got most of that documentation down there from, because a lot of other places would, you know, they would, after, you know, the Civil War, they burned their shit. They were like, we need to, you know, wipe this shit clean. I don't want to be, have anything to do with this, you know, all this stuff. So they got rid of everything. But Texas, for some odd reason, just kept everything. It was all very well documented. And once a lot of people, namely, David Keene, the author of the book that I told you in the intro, Knights of the Golden Circle, Secret Empire, Southern Secession, Civil War. He was a main researcher that found a lot of these documents in Texas and basically thought to himself, well, shit, man, if it was this prominent in Texas, then, you know, what about other states? What about other parts of the countries? And he started tracing it back to George Bickley and Southern Ohio and the Kentucky area. He was one of the main guys who started figuring out, you know, all the castles around Kentucky and Missouri and Tennessee and stuff like that. So, but like I said, nobody really truly knew the identities of, you know, members of the Columbian Star, because that was like the top tier. They were supposed to be kept secret for their safety and for the safety of the Knights of the Golden Circle to keep prospering. Some of the things that the KGC was supposedly involved with, John Wilkes Booth was a known member. There's a couple different places to where he supposedly, you know, got his initiation. I've heard Montreal, but I've also heard, Virginia was, where one author actually traced it back to. Some other people traced it back to Montreal. I honestly, personally, could probably see Virginia more than Montreal, but that's the thing too. The KGC was all the way up north. They were up into the lower parts of Canada and along the eastern front there. And, you know, when we start getting into the KGC treasure and possibly Jesse James, we're not going to touch on the KGC treasure very much because it is just a whole nother 3-part fucking episode or 6 or 8-part episode. There's a lot of information out there on it. There is actually, I believe, a show out there about some Confederate treasure right now that's on, you know, one of the cable TV shows. I'm not sure. You know, they were supposedly running gold all the way up to Canada through, you know, Minnesota, Indiana, Illinois, lots of parts of Michigan. There's supposedly a lot up in Michigan as well. But, you know, they were involved supposedly in a couple assassination and kidnapping attempts of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth, like I said, was a known member. Supposedly, I mean, you want to hear a crazy conspiracy theory? Look up John Wilkes Booth killed by Jesse James. It is stated, I believe, in 1903, if I remember this correctly. I read this probably 2 months ago, and it was, like, so awesome. But supposedly, there's a conspiracy theory out there that, you know, when John Wilkes Booth, whether he lived or not, you know, probably going to be a future episode, not going to lie. You know, whether he lived or not, supposedly, in 1903, he got pneumonia really, really bad when he was, quote-unquote, still alive. And he confessed who he really was, his true identity, to the guy who was taking care of him. Because like I said, he got pneumonia really bad. He was on his deathbed. Well, he ended up recovering and he ended up living. And, the KGC found out about this and they're like, shit, you know, we need to take this fucking dude out. So what they did was they sent Jesse James, AKA Frank Dalton, in 1903, to meet with John Wilkes Booth, because like I said, they were both brothers in the KGC. They take care of their own and they take out their own. So Jesse James showed up. I don't believe he shot him. I believe he poisoned him somehow, if I remember correctly. And as he was leaving, he told the manager of the, like the hotel that he was staying in, you know, hey, you might want to go check on so-and-so up in room, you know, whatever number. And then the guy was found dead, and the hotel manager that did go check on him actually described a guy that looked just like that time period of J. Frank Dalton, which was actually pretty intriguing, really, really interesting. But that's cool little conspiracy theory thing that's wrapped up in there. Well, this whole KGC organization, like I said, is a real thing. And they were funded heavily. Now let's get into how Jesse James gets involved in the KGC, supposedly. All right, so where Jesse James comes into play with the KGC probably has to start with when he joined Bloody Bill Anderson and Quantrill's Raiders and was doing that kind of stuff during the Civil War. Now, supposedly Quantrill was a very high-ranking member in the KGC. As a matter of fact, he was supposedly the treasurer. Now, Bloody Bill Anderson was also a known member, and you can see him in one of his famous photographs. See, I think he only has three of them, and one of them, he's doing his KGC symbol, which, like I mentioned before, KGC symbols and photographs were where you took your right arm, either tucked it in the left part of your jacket on the inside, or you would grab like the right lower part of your collar of your coat, and that was a symbol in a picture that you were KGC. Now, you can see Bloody Bill Anderson doing this in a picture. You can see Wilkes Booth doing this in a picture. And you can see the James boys, Jesse and Frank, both doing it in a wedding reception photo. They are both standing straight up, grabbing at their right collars. So that is supposedly how Jesse James started getting involved in the KGC. We're going to kind of sidetrack here. And we're going to do a little story about Jesse James and, you know, how he got some of his money. Now, if you listened to Astonishing Legends 3-part series on the KGC, then you are familiar with this story. If not, I'm going to retell it right now. During the 1860s, Mexico was pretty much at war, okay? So there was an Austrian archduke named Ferdinand Maximilian. Now, Maximilian was pretty much, he was a Holy Roman Emperor, okay? He goes over to Mexico. He was put in power there by a French emperor named Napoleon III in 1864. While this is going on, as I told you, Mexico was part of the circle. So the KGC did have interest there. And like I had explained to you before, there was a lot of filibustering trying to go on. This was the place, one of the places that they wanted to filibuster. So they sent a lot of troops there. Now, like I had mentioned earlier in the episode, you know, we had generals, Confederate generals that went to Mexico and were fighting there and were also gaining troops for the KGC from Mexico. So what ended up happening was the president of the Mexican Republic, a guy named Benito Juarez. Now he, you know, basically took Maximilian out of power. And how he did that was he had him fucking executed. But how it actually went down was probably about 1865, 1866. Mexico and Maximilian requested troops from the KGC, basically. And what they did was, they asked for like 100 of the best guys that they had. Now, Jesse James was one of these guys, along with Frank James. So they went and they helped out. That's basically how Jesse James got involved with Maximilian and involved in, you know, the conflict in Mexico involving Maximilian and stuff like that. Well, what ends up happening is on June 19th, 1867, Maximilian did get overtaken and executed, along with a bunch of other people, that he was associated with politically, over in Mexico by Benito Juarez. Now, what happens is when they're burying the bodies, they notice that Maximilian is still alive. He's still breathing. So what the guys do is they go to Juarez's people and they're like, listen, you know, this guy is like royalty. He deserves a proper different burial, not with, you know, the rest of these random people, random soldiers. Can we take him elsewhere and properly bury him? Well, what they do is they end up smuggling his body into Texas so they can nurse him back to health. Now, the whole point of this is for them to extract money for the KGC from Maximilian, because Maximilian knows where huge deposits of gold is in Mexico, and he also is royalty, so he has like his own kind of money, okay, a lot of it. So while they're doing this whole little thing, what they do is they call the James boys because they know Jesse James is one of the best out there. Dude is ruthless, okay, and he's super smart. He's trained in guerrilla warfare tactics, all this other stuff, and Frank James just happened to have been a Civil War surgeon when he was with the Confederate Army. So those are the two of the guys that they call, and they needed to keep this a secret. And they knew that the James boys, above anything else, were loyal and they could keep their fucking mouths shut. So they're the ones that they call because it just worked out. It was perfect. So they go to Texas and they're helping Nurse Maximilian back to health. Truly, this whole little Maximilian story involving the James boys, unfortunately, it is speculation, okay? The only place it's really fucking documented is in the book Jesse James Is One of His Names by Del Schrader and Jesse James III, in which it is supposedly a story that is passed down. But what I can confirm is that around the time that Maximilian was executed and, you know, the time that it would have took to get him to Texas, which, like I said, was very, very prominent KGC, and Jesse James was a very prominent figure in Texas as well, along with Frank, on June 19th, 1867 is the supposed date of Maximilian's execution. What I can confirm is that from May 22nd, 1867 to March 20th, 1868, there is no proof of the whereabouts of Jesse and Frank James. They had almost a year right there where their whereabouts are undocumented and unconfirmed. So is this a possibility? Yes, it is a very good possibility. Now, supposedly for getting Maximilian back to health, he awarded Jesse James with $5 million. Now, obviously, as we know from currency exchange or currency, inflation, that would have been an extreme amount of money. And like I had mentioned before, Jesse James, when he died, pretty much died in poverty. He really didn't have anything to show for his money. So then again, that raises the question, you know, what would he have done with all that money? But before we get to that, we do have to try to nail down that Jesse James was, in fact, a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. It's really hard to nail down any kind of documented proof that he was, in fact, a member of the KGC. But here's a couple of the rumors. There's a lot of rumors concerning the newspaper editor that was the master of propaganda, Mr. Edwards. He was supposedly a member of the KGC. He would have been like the, you know, a second degree. He was, you know, one of the editors, the propaganda. He was right there with the money men and stuff like that. You know, and Jesse James, if he was a member, supposedly he became treasurer after William Quantrill died. So there is that little fact. And like I said, this is all speculation. Apparently, there is a noted connection between John Newman Edwards Crittenden, which was the governor of Missouri at the time of Jesse James's death, and Jesse James. Apparently, they had some mutual friends. John Newman Edwards was probably the one person that we can nail down as a known associate of the KGC, if not a full-fledged member himself. And the fact that him and Jesse James were as close as they were does offer a little bit of, I don't want to say proof, but it's fair speculation. It's not out of the realm of possibilities. But what we do know is that if you remember earlier in the episode where I described how Bickley would refer to KGC safe houses and certain land that members owned as castles, well, there was some documentation found that refers to the James Farm as a quote-unquote castle. Now, I cannot for the life of me remember where I saw this documentation. It's not really on the internet. I believe I saw it on a documentary somewhere. You know, this was found later on. You know, probably it was found in the 1920s or 30s. So I don't want to go, I don't want to say that this is actual real evidence, but some of the real evidence that we do have is some of the people that Jesse James was associated with. And we are going to use that to kind of jump into the treasure hunt section. Now, because of part three of Jesse James, I have had probably about a half a dozen people tell me that they have gone and ordered the book called Rebel Gold. And the full title of this book is called Rebel Gold, and it's a one man's quest to crack the code behind the secret treasure of the Confederacy. And it is by Warren Gettler and Bob Brewer. Now, Bob Brewer is a pretty noted KGC treasure hunter, and he did find some deposits of KGC gold in Polk County, Arkansas at one point in time. And it's really difficult because you have to separate KGC gold from Jesse James treasure. Now, KGC gold is a really interesting topic, and it's actually really, really hot right now because of, like I said, there's a cable TV show that has some guys that are looking for it right now. Now, supposedly this gold, you know, they were running trains of Confederate gold. And, you know, the KGC being involved from Canada down through Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, all the way down to Mexico. I mean, through Missouri, Arkansas, all that stuff. And supposedly, at one point in time, the KGC, along with the Confederacy, supposedly accumulated in the late 1800s, $400 million worth of gold that is unaccounted for. Now, $400 million in the late 1800s, I'm not even going to do that conversion because I'm just going to tell you right now that is a shitload of money now. That would be in the billions. So these guys have literally dedicated their life to it. And these were also stories that were passed down generation to generation. Now, if you did, like I said, listen to Astonishing Legends, you know, Superstition Mountains is supposedly one of the hiding spots for some of this treasure, if not a big bulk of it, because of the amount of people that have mysteriously died in the Superstition Mountains that were pretty much murdered. Now, it's pretty much assumed that there are still sentinels guarding this money for the next time that the Confederacy can rise again. Now, I know some of you are probably rolling your eyes like, oh, you know, it's total shit. How many of you believe conspiracy theories that are fucking weirder than that? You know what I'm saying? So, you know, you have to take everything with a grain of salt, but there is evidence to suggest that there is a shitload of treasure out there, specifically in Michigan, the lower parts of Canada, and, you know, around the Missouri area, and then northern Mexico, and then again in the Superstition Mountains. There have been a couple of points in time, you know, I don't really trust TV shows that, you know, try to uncover, you know, Jesse James gold and KGC treasure. But yeah, you know, you just got to take that kind of shit with a grain of salt. But if it were me, if I were treasure hunting, there is one place that I personally found that is of extreme interest to me. And it's not only because it's close to where I live, but because this not only offers evidence of possible treasure, but it also offers the evidence that Jesse James was on paper documented in the KGC. Now, as we know, Jesse James was documented to be around the Ohio area at a certain point in time because of robberies and letters, you know, that were going back and forth to him and other various people while he was in the height of his bank and train robbing. So there is a place in Ohio, and it's Richland County. All right, this is just southwest of Mansfield, and a little town called Lexington. Lexington, Ohio, not Kentucky, and then another little town called Millsboro, which is just to the northwest, about 10-minute drive of Lexington. And then you have a little reservoir called the Clear Fork Reservoir. So how this story ends up evolving into a treasure hunt, for me personally, this is where I think if you're going to go anywhere to treasure hunt, that you probably have a good chance of finding anything if anything is going to be there. So in 1880, this stranger rides into Lexington. His name is Levi Rumsey. Now everybody referred to him as Captain. Now they assumed that he was a captain in the Civil War, but couldn't really determine on which side he fought for. Now, if you remember, like I had said, Lexington, Ohio, the South Ohio area around Cincinnati, stuff like that, this is where the KGC started from, okay? This is where the bigger concentrated castles are. So this Levi Rumsey rides into town. He's referred to as Captain. He was honestly this, he was described as loud, determined, rich, and a little shady. Now, Lexington people were convinced that he was a horse thief because when he shows up to buy this guy's farm, a guy named John Graham, which was just west of Lexington, he had a lot of very good horses. So the people around Lexington are like, okay, this dude's a little shady because only a horse thief would have this many badass horses around, all right? So Levi Rumsey approaches Graham, this guy named John Graham, and he says, I want to buy your farm. Now, he wanted to buy John Graham's farm because it was about 221 acres, and it was out of public view. It was a perfect location to do things that not everybody's going to be able to see. Well, John Graham looks at him and he didn't want to sell his farm. So he just told him some fucking crazy price and he figured, oh, this guy's going to walk away. But, that didn't happen. When he told him this outrageous price, Levi Rumsey reached into his pocket, pulled out little bars of gold that were about, I don't know, about the size of the palm of your hand, and gave it to him. So he ended up getting this farm from John Graham, much to John Graham's surprise. So like I said, all these neighbors, you know, there's this new weird guy in town. He's got all this money and gold bars. You know, he's referred to as Captain Levi Rumsey, but he has no known affiliation with either side of the Civil War, and he has all of these horses, okay? Now, around 1880, Jesse James is spotted by several witnesses out at the Rumsey farm. Now, all this gossip and stuff started, you know, everybody's little chatty Cathy's, everybody starts talking. Now, because, you know, Jesse James was spotted at the Rumsey farm several times with other guys, you know, supposedly his gang, and the people in Lexington described, you know, the guys that would go to the Rumsey farm as being just dead-eyed, just wild-eyed, rough. They pretty much described them as like the criminal element, you know, because we were cool with stereotyping shit back then, you know what I mean? So, you know, they would often describe these guys that would go to the Rumsey farm. They wouldn't even, they're just like, man, these guys are bad fucking news, and they frequent this place. Like, you know, they already thought somehow Rumsey was, you know, a criminal of sorts because of the amount of horses and the fact that he's buying this huge fucking farm over cost with bars of gold, okay? The best part is after Jesse James died, Rumsey took off. He literally left. And I mean, I'm pretty fucking sure his whereabouts afterward were unaccounted for. But I thought that was a pretty interesting little side note. So after all, you know, right about to the time of the 1920s is where all this Jesse James's gold, you know, started coming forth. They're like, listen, he had to have fucking hoarded all this gold and all this money somewhere. And since he was previously spotted a lot of times on the Rumsey farm, people started, you know, looking at the Rumsey land, the old Rumsey land, like, you know, maybe there's a good chance that he hid some money here. Now, one of the things about the Rumsey farm is there's no notable landmarks. And the KGC was very, very well known for actually doing little treasure maps, but they were heavily coded. I mean, in that, and they would fucking graft trees. They would rope the tree branches and make them form different symbols. And in all honesty, where some of the deposits of KGC gold was found is supposedly a mark of Jesse James as well. If you looked at my Instagram at Mysterious Podcast, I posted some pictures the other day, a Jesse James supposed symbol that where some deposits were found, and it is a capital J back to back, you know, with it crossed on top, so it kind of looks like an anchor. Now, this was supposedly the symbol that Jesse James used to mark where he personally would bury money, you know, for other people, because Jesse James supposedly inherited the role of treasurer after Quantrill died, and he was a very, very high-ranking member. Now, since there weren't many trees and stuff like that to use as markers around the Rumsey farm, people started following the Clear Fork River. Now, you can follow this all the way up, and there's a bunch of hills and stuff like that, and then there's a valley too. And what it does is, like I said, about 10 minutes northwest by drive, it's actually about 5 miles from Lexington, is a little village called Millsboro. In between Lexington and Millsboro, right along the Clear Fork River, is supposedly some of the spots that Jesse James would have buried treasure while he was in the area. So there's a cave there by the river where a lot of activity was seen while Rumsey and these strange guys that would show up would hang out. And this is supposedly where a lot of this money was buried. Now, in the early 1900s, this cave kind of, started falling apart, started caving in. But in the 1940s, someone, you know, actually took the effort to get in there. And it started getting really dangerous because all these gold hunters started coming to this cave to start searching for treasure. Because this is, locally, this is a huge legend, all right, around this area. Now, in the 1950s, the cave was blasted closed, so pretty much nobody could ever get in there afterward. I'm not, you know, it was pretty much for safety reasons. They didn't want anybody to get hurt. Now, a lot of these stories have been backtracked by, you know, historians and descendants of the James brothers about them being around in this area. Now, how this all comes into play, the Richland connection, the Richland County connection, okay, is, in all honesty, if you're a Southerner and you're going to hide treasure, where's the one place that you don't think anybody is going to look for your money? It's probably going to be on the north half of the country where all your enemies were. And there is documented proof that a lot of people in Richland County did support the Southern cause. So there were some friendlies up there. There were some allies that Jesse James had. Now, in a newspaper clipping from the Cleveland Herald in October 31st, 1861, it specifically says, "The Richland KGCs, in noticing the exposure of the treasonable Knights of the Golden Circle, the Mansfield Herald states that some weeks ago it had information of over 1,000 members in Richland County alone, and adds, we may state another fact, the demand for Navy revolvers this summer has been unprecedented, and today the number of arms in private hands, if known, would astonish all save the initiated. We hope now that this secret society is exposed. Detective officers may succeed in ferreting out every traitor engaged in spreading the disaffection and treason throughout the state." Now, this is documented fact This right here says that there were over 1,000 documented members of the KGC in Richland County alone. Now, this makes sense to me. This is where I start connecting, like, all these dots right here. Now, above that, there was another little clue left from the 1880s by Richland, a Shield and Banner, which was their local paper. Now, the Shield and Banner was the propaganda sheet for the Democratic Party, which at the time was pro-Confederacy. Now, like I had said, Richland County, there were a lot of pro-Confederates there, even though it was in the north, and this being right by the birthplace of the KGC. Now, the newspaper publicly listed that Levi Rumsey was among one of its subscribers, and in one little clipping, it actually refers to the Rumsey House as his castle. Now, like I said, castle was a code word used to indicate, you know, a rendezvous place or a KGC safe house. Now, there is also documentation from letters to and from the James Gang, where quite a few home sites and stables and hideout locations that were all referred to as castles as well. And that would also include Rumsey's Castle, and that in Richland County, where they had specifically talked about going in these documented letters. And then you also have the newspaper clipping that was found later on in the 30s or 20s or something like that, in the early 1900s, that referred to the James Farm itself as the James Castle. So, if I was going to start treasure hunting, I would personally start around the Clear Fork Mohican River area, and I would work my way up north, not going past Millsboro, which would be specifically right around State Road 97, where it crosses the old Levi Rumsey farm. Now, if you can find a body of water, some kind of cave area, or any kind of valleys with any weird symbols, or you see any trees that are bent in weird shapes, that would probably be the first place that I would look, because there is documented evidence of KGC, of Jesse James, and of large quantities of money and very, very bad people that used to culminate around that area. So, happy hunting, Ohio. I hope all of you enjoyed part 4. I apologize it took so long. This was a lot of information that I had to fact check. I have to make sure that I put out a quality product, and if I'm not happy with it, I'm not going to put it out. So, thank you very, very much for being patient, and stay tuned after the outro music for some reviews. Thank you again. All right, first one I apparently did not know about, and it was from Lab Buddy from 2 months ago. It was on Stitcher, I think. I didn't even see it there, so I apologize. And if I already read it, then I apologize again. But it's from Lab Buddy, 5 stars. It says, relaxed true crime. A great true crime show. The subjects are thought-provoking and well-researched. Justin does a great job of presenting the facts and giving plausible theories. The relaxed atmosphere makes it feel like you are bullshitting at a bar with an old friend. A perfect combination of excellent research and charm. I couldn't recommend it more. Lab Buddy, thank you so much for that. And I feel so fucking bad that I didn't even notice it. I don't get notifications for Stitcher reviews, and I very rarely actually check there. So I do apologize, but thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad the whole way that I wanted to do this podcast is coming around, and everybody can appreciate that. Well, most people can appreciate it, about half of you. All right, this next one is from the USA. It is a brand new one. She actually messaged me on Instagram talking about my episodes, which is fucking awesome. I love it when you guys, like, you know, hit me up and say, hey, man, that was a great episode, or give me suggestions and stuff like that. Super, super awesome. And goddamn, I hope I pronounced her name right. It's Andigne, I think. Andigne. It's 5 stars. I'm sorry if I fucked that up on her. I apologize. But it's 5 stars. Says Justin is great. Justin gives great narrative of the evidence and the theories. His guests are on point and have relevant knowledge of the case. I have noticed that he sometimes gets a tad bit off the main subject, but it is most of the time still relating to the case being discussed. I always love the side roads along Justin's storytelling journey. Also, he is quick to respond to listeners when they reach out with questions or suggestions, very approachable, and to use his words, fucking cool. Yeah, I'm not toot my own horn, but I think I'm pretty fucking awesome most of the time, but thank you very much for that. I'm glad she actually enjoyed a few of my big series, so thank you again. I'm going to save that 1 star for next to last. Next one is 5 stars from Torch Angel, and it says, keep up the great work. It says, keep it up. I love your honesty and transparency. You are one of my new faves. Well, you know what? You're one of my new faves too, Torch Angel. You are fucking awesome. And thank you very much for taking that time to leave that review. Next one is from Black Macabre, who follows me on Instagram. I love his posts, man. Yeah, keep that shit up, dude. It says 5 stars. Yes. Great stuff, man. Keep it up. You cover topics a lot of others don't, and I really dig that. Thank you very much, man. I really like, not to cover, shit that everybody else does. Don't get me wrong. I do sometimes, but I usually try to take a different approach or find more information on those subjects. So I appreciate that, sir. Thank you. Next one's from Bartleby the Listener. It says 5 stars. Relaxed, conversational, well-researched. I really like Justin's style. He has dropped many of the formalities and kept all the necessary things of a history mystery podcast. He has a foul mouth, much as do I myself, but unfailingly polite and empathetic. There are a zillion people reading history notes on a podcast. This one stands out for listenability, quality of research, and disdain for formality. Goddamn, that is very complimentary. Thank you, Bartleby the Listener. I thank you very, very much. That was fucking awesome. Next one is from 5 stars, says Iceland, 913. 5 stars says, yes, happiness in a podcast. This podcast brings me so much joy. I've lived in Indiana since I was a kiddo, and Justin's voice and storytelling skills are a perfect pair. I wish I'd found this podcast sooner. Well, to be honest, I wish you would have found it sooner too, but, nobody's perfect, I guess. Nah, I'm just blowing you shit. No, I really appreciate that. I always love getting reviews from the home state audience. I'm glad everybody in Indiana, can appreciate the shit. So thank you very, very much. Next one, I can't remember if I read this last time or not, but this is from SBH27. It's 5 stars, great podcast, one of the best researched pods out there, innovator of the genre. Justin is the man. Oh no, you are the fucking man or woman. I'm not sure what you are, but I appreciate that. Thank you, like I said, for taking the time to leave that review. Next up is a 1 star. Yes. It's from somebody literally named me, and then they put a smiley face emoji with their fucking tongue hanging out. It says 1 star, my fucking pity star. It says, get an editor. This guy meanders all over the place. About 2/3 of the show is asides. Now, what was funny as fuck is that, as a lot of you know, I do post my 1 star reviews on social media because I get tired of trying to defend my shit. So I just let all my listeners fucking just, get savage on your stupid asses. And I fucking love reading the comments, but half of them were, what the fuck does asides even mean? And I think what they're meaning is when I always say, well, aside from that, or aside from this, listen, you know, everything that I talk about, whether it goes like off point for the most part, is relative to the subject at hand. It does tie into the subject. So, you know, me, I guess, you know, I'm not going to get an editor. I tell you what, you fucking donate to my cause, I'll fucking pay for an editor. But until then, you can kiss my pasty white ass. Let's see what we got next. I actually had a review that specifically was referenced to that one. And this one is from my dear friend Tanya Espana from Canada. It's 5 stars. And it says, he's got an editor himself. Justin has a great podcast. It's like you're having a conversation with him. He's got tons of facts and great delivery. Then he goes off, when he goes off on an aside, it adds to the whole vibe of the show. Also, I bet he makes great fried egg sandwich. Fucking Tanya. I know a few of my listeners met Tanya down at CrimeCon, and she is very active in the Facebook group as well. She's a fucking character. We'll just put it that. No, in all honesty, I love her to death, and she's fucking one of the funniest people I think I've ever met in my life. And she hit the nail on the head because, yeah, I do make pretty much the greatest fucking fried egg sandwich on the planet. So, you know, 5 stars for you, Tanya Espana. 5 stars for me as well. All right, let's see what else we got, because I do know I haven't gotten to Facebook reviews yet, and I do apologize about that. Let me find this fucking one. I got one from Sweden from Anna. She actually messaged it to me, which was super awesome. You know, she's like, this is the review I left for you. She, actually tagged me in a post on Instagram because she enjoyed the Marilyn Monroe episode so much, which was fucking awesome too. I love it when you guys do that. It's like, hey, fucking, if you enjoy an episode, fucking call me out, dude. I'll repost that shit. I think it's super awesome. But let's see what she has to say here. And it is great podcast, 5 stars, from Anna. Says, Justin gives you his honest opinions on some really mysterious circumstances indeed. He is witty, thorough in his research, and seems to be a really cool dude. Beware of some cussing, but it's heartfelt and true, Anna. Anna, I can't thank you enough for that. You're fucking awesome. It was funny. We actually had a pretty cool, conversation on the Facebook, page and stuff like that. She's a super awesome chick. And, yeah, I'm glad she took the time to leave a review. I love it when, I get reviews from other countries. It's pretty fucking awesome. Makes me feel kind of good. But anywho, that's all that I got for you. About 10 minutes worth of shit right there. So until next time, I will see you guys on the flip side.